Hello, everybody. I am John Allen, and this is Last Week in the Church, the show where we harvest the fruits of the last week on the Vatican and Global Catholic Church beat, hopefully extracting those few precious, ripe pieces of fruit, serving them up nice, fresh, and delicious. Here's what's on the menu for this week. We begin with health, hype, and hope. We find ourselves in the middle of another mini-crisis surrounding Pope Francis's health after he skipped the homily at his Palm Sunday Mass on Sunday. We will try to explain to you the contest that is going on between hype over the end may be near and hope that this actually is meaningless and that there's nothing to see here. We'll try to unpack what the reality is beneath those competing narratives. Second, we've got the Germans blink first in a kind of high-stakes showdown between senior Vatican officials, in fact, just about as senior as they come, short of the Pope himself, and the leadership of the German Bishops' Conference. The Germans essentially promise to be good boys when it comes to the implementation of their controversial synodal way. We'll explain what was said and what to expect going forward. Third, we have high anxiety. That describes the state of things in Europe in the wake of the terrorist attack in Moscow that at latest count has left 139 people dead. We'll explain what additional security measures we might expect this week in Rome as the annual Christian calendar reaches its crescendo in Holy Week. Fourth, we've got this is an ex-cleric. That, of course, an homage to the famous Monty Python ex-parrot sketch, only in this case, the subject is a good deal more serious. A Belgian cleric has been expelled not only as a bishop, but as a priest, on the back of sexual abuse to which he admitted some 14 years ago. We'll explain why it took so long, and perhaps why it is happening now. And finally, fifth, we've got the social gospel, how the death of the martyrdom, really, of an Italian Catholic priest 80 years ago this past Sunday captures the birth of Catholic social teaching in miniature. All that and more is waiting for you on this edition of Last Week in the Church, so please stay where you are because I will be right back.
Crux wishes to thank our advertising sponsor, PushPay, for their support of Crux and this episode of Last Week in the Church. If your parish wants to increase giving, deepen engagement, and fulfill their mission, then PushPay's all-in-one digital solution, Parish Stack, is what you need. Learn more at pushpay.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Happy Wednesday to you. Happy Wednesday, March 27th. Hope you are having a fantastic Holy Week so far. We are, of course, a day late, once again, off our normal release schedule of Tuesdays. But with everything going on right now, there are going to be times periodically when we come out perhaps a day or so late. We apologize for that. But, you know, whatever we lack in punctuality, we are going to try to make up for in perspicacity. How's that for a P word? All right, let's dive in this week. We have health, hype, and hope. Pope Francis on Sunday generated what can only be described as a kind of mini tempest around the state of his health by failing to deliver his homily at the Palm Sunday Mass. Now, at one level, that shouldn't produce any particular frisson. The Pope, for some weeks now, in fact, some months now, has been battling what the Vatican has at various points described as a cold, the flu, bronchitis, but in any event, has been struggling with difficulties in terms of breathing and public speaking because of the breathing difficulties, and has on multiple occasions, including most recently in public, the Wednesday before the Palm Sunday Mass during his general audience, he has often asked somebody else to read his prepared text for him. And had that been what happened on Palm Sunday, I don't suspect anyone would have been unduly alarmed because it would have fit the narrative that we have already seen. And that narrative typically is Pope Francis will come at a public event, he will open up with a few remarks of his own, then he'll have somebody else read the canned speech, and then he usually comes back at the end with a few either off-the-cuff or semi-off-the-cuff remarks, and generally then shakes hands, slaps backs, kisses babies, seems basically fine, apart from the breathing difficulties. So, you know, had that been the deal on Palm Sunday, I don't think anybody's blood pressure would have shot through the roof, but that's not quite what happened. Instead, what happened is that that morning, the Vatican, as is standard practice, sent an advance copy of the Pope's homily to journalists under embargo, meaning we can't publish it until he actually reads it. And, you know, what people do is they prepare stories based on that advance copy so they can be ready to go when the time comes. Among them, my wife Elise, one of her typically erudite and elan-filled analyses of the papal homily, so we were all good to go. And, you know, we had the Mass on the live feed from the Vatican. And, of course, as you know, the Palm Sunday Gospel is the longest Gospel of the year. You know, it takes, what, half hour, 40 minutes, depending on how it's done, to play out. So at the very end of this very long Gospel, there was this sort of agonizing silence when Pope Francis had been repositioned, because during the Gospel, he was sitting facing the altar, that is, with his back sort of to the crowd. He had been repositioned so that he was facing the crowd. And there was this long silence where people, for all the world, it seemed as if everyone was waiting for him to speak. And nothing happened. And then after a couple of moments, it was announced to the crowd that the Pope had decided not to deliver his homily and that we were moving immediately to the profession of faith. Now, that in itself was sort of shocking, I mean, in the sense that it seemed that this caught everyone off guard. That is, that this had not been planned in advance. And then the Vatican didn't, to be honest with you, really help itself as things played out. Because after a little bit, we got communique from the Vatican about the Palm Sunday Mass, which basically simply said that after the Gospel, after a period of reflection after the Gospel, the Mass continued. Well, okay. Which, you know, they were, in other words, they were trying to make it sound like nothing to see here. This is all, you know, it's the old vaudeville rule, right? No matter what happens, make it look like part of the act. And so that seemed to be what they were trying to do. And then, just to compound the silliness, later we got another note from the Vatican saying that because the homily had not been delivered, it did not exist. Now, that's just ridiculous. I mean, the homily obviously exists. You know, most people in the Vatican press corps have, what they should have said, of course, is that it should not be considered official, or it should not be written about because it wasn't delivered and therefore was not whittled by the Pope. Okay, that's fine. But to claim that it didn't exist is a little silly. So what are we to make of all of this? Let us add that after the Pope skipped his homily, later, at the conclusion of the liturgy, he delivered his traditional noontime Sunday Angelus address in his own voice, seemed perfectly capable of doing that, and then was able to climb into the back of the Pope Mobile and do his normal swing through St. Peter's Square. Camera, of course, at his back the whole time, and he seemed animated, relaxed, energized, and thoroughly enjoying himself. So, look, I don't think anybody believes that we are at the same place we were when Pope John Paul II, famously skipped his homily at his last Palm Sunday Mass in 2005, and then 3 weeks later was dead. I don't think anyone believes that it's the same level of gravity right now. Although, on the other hand, of course, we are talking about an 87-year-old Pope who has had, you know, just in the last year, a couple of major surgeries, and who has got a variety of different medical conditions. Now, his surgeon, by the way, gave an interview to an Italian news outlet this week, basically saying he didn't see any particular reason to be concerned. He said the Pope has the mind of a 60-year-old, but the body of an 87-year-old. He has the normal ailments that come with that, but according to Dr. Sergio Alfieri, seems to be coping with those ailments perfectly fine, and there's every reason to believe that he's good to go for a while. So, bottom line, is this cause for concern? Absolutely, yes, it is. Are we on a death watch? I would say that for most observers right now, the answer to that question is no. They would probably also add, stay tuned. All right, second up this week, we've got the Germans blink first. So, you know, one of the long-running sagas in global Catholicism over the last few years has been the German synodal way and the perception that it is running ahead of Pope Francis's own reform agenda, that is going places that Pope Francis does not want them to go, at least not yet, and that therefore creating the risk that things are just going to spin out of control. To some extent, this is about contested issues in the church, such as the blessing of same-sex marriages, not just unions, but marriages, women clergy, married priests, and on and on, all things that the German synodal way, in one way or another, seemed to endorse. But tensions of late have come to a head over governance. That is, a new plan for governance of the German Catholic Church that came out as a result of this synodal way, which envisions not a conference of bishops making decisions for the German Church, but rather a new council that can be composed of both laity and bishops. And in fact, if you look at the draft statutes, it would be composed of, well, decisions would be made on a two-thirds basis, and the number of bishops who would be part of this council would be just one vote short of a third, meaning, in theory, binding decisions could be made for the church in Germany without a single bishop saying yes. Okay? Now, the Vatican had, on several occasions, told the Germans, you can't do that, that it subverts the hierarchical nature of the church. The Germans seemed to say, oh, well, you know, thanks for the advice, but we're going to go ahead anyway. In other words, every time the Vatican tried to change the light to red, the Germans just blew through the intersection. Well, so all that leads to a high-profile meeting that took place this week here in Rome, or last week, rather, between the leadership of the German Bishops' Conference and a kind of all-star lineup of Vatican heavy hitters. So you had Secretary of State Cardinal Pietro Parolin, Cardinal Robert Prevost, who heads the Dicastery for Bishops, Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, who heads the Dicastery for the Faith, other big guns in the Vatican arsenal. And at the end of this meeting, which was an all-day meeting, okay, at the end of it, the Vatican and the German bishops put out a joint communique, which is already something. I mean, because basically this is the Vatican telling the Germans, we don't trust you to spin this on your own, so we're going to put out a joint statement. And essentially what the joint statement said was that the Germans had promised that whatever they do will be consistent with the ecclesiology, the Second Vatican Council, the provisions of the Code of Canon Law, the fruits of the Pope's Synod of Bishops on Synodality, and that it would all be done only with the prior approval of the Vatican. In other words, the Germans basically blanked, basically said, we are not going to act on our own, but we will instead make sure that whatever we do is okay with you. Now, going forward, what does that mean? Well, that's a very interesting question, because let's be fair, the pressures on the German bishops to act without the Vatican's prior approval, that is, to sort of go their own way, are enormous. I mean, not only do we have the historical legacy of the Protestant Reformation in Germany, which created what the late Swiss theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar famously described as the anti-Roman affect, that is, a kind of anti-Roman impulse that is part of the DNA of German Catholicism. But you also have ecumenical relations in Germany and the constant need for Catholics to prove to Lutherans that they aren't just stooges of the Pope, but they are servants of the gospel first. And there is simply secular public opinion in Germany, one of the world's most secular societies, where the legacy of the clerical sexual abuse scandals place enormous pressure on the bishops to satisfy secular expectations, not just the Vatican's wishes. And so how they are going to navigate those shoals remains to be seen. Obviously, we will keep an eye on it at Crux. All right. Third up this week, high anxiety. So in the wake of the terrorist attack on that concert hall in Moscow, that at latest count at least has left 139 people dead, more than 100 injured, and some still missing, all across Europe, alarms have gone off. But that is true in a particular way here in Rome, of course, because we are in the middle of Holy Week, where exposure is in some ways at its annual peak, because we have several high-profile events that are set to draw major crowds, and which therefore, unfortunately, also create very inviting terrorist targets. So that includes the Good Friday, the annual Good Friday procession scheduled this week for Rome's Colosseum. The Pope is supposed to preside, that of course assuming that his health allows. It may be because it's an evening event and in the open air. His doctors counsel him not to do it, and he will ask somebody to preside in his name. That has yet to be decided. We don't know what's going to happen. But in any event, whether the Pope goes or not, it is still going to be a big public event. And then, of course, you know, we have the Easter Sunday liturgy in St. Peter's Square, the Urbi et Orbi blessing, and all of that. And the reality is that here in Rome, all of that has created a deep level of concern among security officials who have announced that they are ratcheting up both physical controls. Excuse me, I'm getting over a cold and I'm coughing a lot. But in any event, they are ratcheting up physical controls. So that's going to mean a heavier, thicker police presence at those public events, that is Good Friday, Easter Sunday. They are also ratcheting up virtual controls. So they are checking, you know, social media and known terrorist bulletin boards and websites and so forth for the kind of chatter that might indicate something coming. Security officials here have said that there has been no specific credible threat yet. Although, on the other hand, there was a small town in Puglia, that's in southern Italy, just a couple days ago, where a section of the Italian railroad had to be shut down for several hours because there was a threat turned out to be a hoax. But somebody had posted a piece of paper on a bulletin board in a train station saying that the train was going to be struck that day with a signature in Arabic. And this resulted in a closure of several hours, obviously inspection for bombs and all of that. You know, we don't know if something like that might happen during one of the events on the Holy Week calendar that might cause disruptions, delays, consternation. We will see, but this is the unfortunate legacy. We should note that during that Angelus address this past Sunday, which the Pope did deliver in his own voice, he did refer to the Moscow terrorist attack, calling it vile and inhuman, expressing his closeness and his prayers for victims and their families. So the Pope has denounced that attack. Whether that might simply make it more likely that some terrorist faction or another might decide to try to target something in or around the Vatican during Holy Week remains to be seen. We know in the meantime that both the Vatican's own security forces and Italian security forces are doing everything they can to forestall that. All right, fourth up this week, this is an ex-cleric. And this, of course, a reference to the case of now ex-bishop and ex-priest Roger Van Heluwe of Belgium. He was the Bishop of Bruges in Belgium until his retirement in 2010, and we probably ought to describe it as his forced retirement, because it came amid revelations that he had engaged in a pattern of sexual abuse of his own nephew, beginning over a period of 13 years, beginning when the boy was just 5 years old, and extending until he was 18. And this coincided with the period when Van Heluwe was a priest and then later became a bishop. In other words, whatever vetting process went on to justify the decision to make him a bishop, it failed to uncover this abuse. Now, listen, you know, the revelation that Van Heluwe had abused his own nephew, beginning at the age of five, that obviously was shocking and horrific enough. But it just kind of got worse as things went on, because in an interview that Van Heluwe gave around shortly after his resignation, not only did he acknowledge abusing a second nephew, but he also appeared to kind of minimize what he had done. He first denied being a pedophile, even though sexually abusing males who were minors is kind of the dictionary definition of pedophilia. But he also said, and I'm not making this up, he basically said, he didn't understand why people were making such a big deal over this because it didn't involve, quote-unquote, rough sex. You know, I mean, the very, you know, apotheosis, right, of someone in denial about what they had done. And just to make matters worse, a recording also emerged of Cardinal Godfried Danneels, who had been the very powerful Cardinal of Brussels, at one time considered a candidate to be Pope. A recording emerged of him trying to persuade one of these accusers, Van Heluwe, not to come forward until after the bishop had reached his normal retirement age of 75 in order to spare him the embarrassment In other words, encouraging that this accusation be swept under the rug. None of this was a good optic for the Catholic Church in Belgium. Now, when Vanhy Louis retired in 2010, shortly afterwards, police in Belgium announced that they were unable to prosecute because the statute of limitations under Belgian criminal law for what Vanhy Louis had acknowledged doing, that statute of limitations had already passed. But there was expectation that there would be some kind of canonical procedure against Vanhy Louis. You know, the Vatican said, we're looking into it. But then time passed and nothing happened. Now, of course, this acknowledgement and his resignation happened under Pope Benedict XVI. 2 years later, a new pope takes office, Francis. There was some expectation at that point that perhaps the tides would turn and something would be done. But yet, again, nothing happened. Periodically, the bishops of Belgium would tell the press, because they have been under intense public pressure all of this time, to try to explain why nothing has been done. So periodically, the bishops of Belgium would appeal to the Vatican to take action, but it seemed to pass into the ether and that nothing was done. All of which brings us to this past week, where after 14 years, it was announced that Vanhy Louis had been laicized. That is, not only removed as a bishop, but dismissed from the priesthood, from the clerical state altogether. And this, according to a statement from the Vatican Embassy in Belgium, in part because new information, they didn't specify what, but they said new information had come to light that had reactivated the canonical process against him. It was also announced that this had been decided by the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith and executed with the personal approval of Pope Francis. Now, in answer to the question of why is this all happening now, well, again, we don't know what this alleged new information may have been. That certainly may be part of the picture, but most observers would suggest it is also related to the fact that the Vatican has quasi-confirmed that the Pope is going to be traveling to Belgium in September to celebrate the anniversary of the Catholic University of Leuven. And it would be very difficult, I think most people believe, for the Pope to set foot on Belgian soil while the Vanhy Louis case was still hanging over his head. In other words, I think, you know, in terms of the climate of public opinion in Belgium, the takeaway most people seem to have reached about this is that the fact that belatedly, anyway, Vanhy Louis has been sanctioned, that is, laicized, on the basis of his acknowledged abuse, has less to do with the inherent merits of the case and more to do with the PR optics of a looming papal trip. Now, of course, we don't even know if Francis is going to make that trip. It will depend on the vicissitudes of his health between now and then. But in any event, my point is this, that the fact that Vanhy Louis has been laicized hardly takes his case off the table in terms of the climate of public opinion that Pope Francis will be facing when and if he does go to Belgium, which means the challenge he is going to face on that trip is going to be fairly steep. He's going to stand in front of a somewhat skeptical, somewhat jaded and cynical public in Belgium and have to make the case that the Catholic Church's commitment to reform on his watch isn't just cosmetic, but that it is substantive and real. He is going to have to give some kind of explanation for why it took so long for the laicization of Vanhy Louis to arrive. He will probably also have to explain why he decided to make another Belgian bishop, Van Louis, who had been accused of covering up sex crimes, why he had decided to make him a cardinal and had to back down only under appeals from Van Louis himself and other Belgian bishops, saying we can't do this because of how it's going to affect the sensitivities of abuse victims and their families and so on. All of that is something that the Pope will be pressured to make sense of should he actually make this trip to Belgium, which would mean that even though it is a trip to a small country for an event that is really not of much interest in itself, that is the anniversary of the Catholic University, not of much interest outside Catholic circles in Belgium, and what is likely to be a short, maybe at best, overnight voyage, despite all of that, could actually be one of the most challenging trips Pope Francis takes in 2024, assuming he's able to do it. Final This week, we have the social gospel. This past Sunday marked the 80th anniversary of the Fosse Ardeatine, that is, the massacres of the Ardeatine Caves here in Rome. It was one of the most horrific civilian massacres during World War II. It occurred on March 24th, 1944. Basically, what had happened the day before, the Italian resistance had attacked a column of German soldiers in Rome who were occupying Rome. 33 German soldiers were killed in the attack, so the Nazis decided to kill 10 Italians. For every one German who was killed, they ended up massacring 335 Italians in these caves on the southern outskirts of Rome near the catacombs. One Italian priest was among them, Don, that is, Father Pietro Papagallo, whose story in miniature sort of reflects the birth of the Catholic social gospel. He was born in 1888 in southern Italy. He was inspired very much by Pope Benedict XV, the original peace pope, who condemned the First World War as useless slaughter. Father Papagallo was ordained in 1915, and he had Pope Benedict XV's famous peace prayer printed on the holy card for the first mass that he celebrated in 1915. Later, Papagallo came to Rome. He became a kind of Norma Rae, a kind of semi-union organizer on behalf of impoverished southern Italians who were coming north in search of work. They ended up in these factories where they were overworked, underpaid, essentially starved to death, made to work in horrifically unsafe conditions with no medical coverage, no social security, nothing like that. I mean, it was robber baron capitalism at its very worst. Don Papagallo has tried to stand up to all of that. Later on, during the Second World War, and especially after the Nazis occupied Rome in 1943, he opened his apartment to dissidents, and those dissidents included monarchists, Catholics, communists, anybody who was sort of anti-fascist or hunted by the regime. They could find refuge, find a home in Don Papagallo's apartment. He had two nephews in Rome who were running a print shop, and they were churning out false passports and other documents for these people to help get them out. Among those Don Papagallo saved were dozens of Jews who had taken refuge in his apartment, got false passports from his cousins, and then were able to make their way safely out of Italy. Eventually, of course, an informant turned Don Papagallo in. He was arrested in January 1944 by the Nazis, tortured at their famous Gestapo headquarters in the Via Tasella here in Rome. And then eventually, he was among those who were executed in the Fosse Ardeatine in March. In other words, if you take the commitment to peace, the commitment to the rights of labor, the commitment to human rights, democracy, and justice, all of which today are kind of cardinal principles of Catholic social teaching, all of which stemmed from, you know, the late 19th century, the papacy of Leo XIII, and flowered in the early 20th century. I mean, it's one thing to cite papal encyclicals to make that point, but if you look at the trajectory of Father Pietro Papagallo's life, all of those cardinal principles are reflected in sacrifices he made in flesh and bone, and he eventually gave his life to defend those principles. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a story worth telling. He has not yet formally been beatified, but a cause is underway. But I'm just going to jump the gun and say, blessed Pietro Papagallo, pray for us. All right, that is our story this week. You can find full coverage of all of, or that is our show, rather. You can find full coverage of all of these stories on the Crux site, cruxnow.com. I will be back here next week, same bat time, same bat channel. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy, have a fantastic and holy, holy week, and we will talk to you again very soon.